This afternoon, then, we take up the issue that we spoke of this morning, the issue of Christians and the drinking of intoxicating beverages. The issue is pleasure drinking. That is, the drinking of intoxicants for personal enjoyment. Now, maybe some don't like me using such phrases, intoxicants. That's what they are. And they might not like me using the phrase pleasure drinking. Well, it is drinking for your own pleasure. That's what we're talking about. Increasing numbers of Christians, perhaps especially among that demographic described as the young, reformed, and restless, insist on their right to drink intoxicants, so long as they don't get drunk. Now, drunkenness is a strange thing. There is the obvious, what we could call the dead drunk condition, and there are various stages of intoxication that lead up to it. So I'm wondering, how do these people define intoxication? What about those early stages where one can feel the alcohol taking effect, yet can still act normal, but still be affected to some extent, for instance, as to thought processes and reflexes? Is it just fine to drink intoxicants up to that stage and then, of course, stop? Is that it? What should we counsel young people here? How do one of these drinking ministers counsel young people? The young person who asks, well, how much is permissible for me to drink? Well, the type of alcohol, the weight of the person, the gender, the natural tolerance level for alcohol, the physical or emotional condition at a given time, whether one eats at the same time one drinks, the span of time over which one drinks, what one is drinking, these all are variables with regard to the question, how much is safe to drink? And it's a fact that every person has that point where if they ingest a bit more than a certain amount of intoxicant, and the point does vary with the same person from time to time, but if they just go a little bit more above, a little bit above a certain amount, the likelihood then increases that they will have another drink. Their inhibitions begin to lower. And then with another drink, the odds multiply that they will have another drink. And so it continues exponentially at some point. So this endorsing of pleasure drinking is a very, very serious thing. It's going to cause a great deal of pain, loss, shame, and damage to individuals in the cause of Christ. The issue we've taken up, then, is the drinking of intoxicating beverages. Not of any necessity, but by choice for enjoyment. And so I've been using that term pleasure drinking. Early on, I made the statement, I say this morning it would have been, that I'm not going to contest that a very small amount of wine on a regular basis may well have certain health benefits. I'm not going to point the accusing finger at some Christian brother or sister who takes a small amount of wine for some perceived health benefit. But that person, that Christian, if he's going to make use of wine that way, he had better buy it where he's not known or she isn't known, since everyone that sees him or her buy it, they witness his transaction, are they going to know how much the person drinks, the Christian drinks, and why? In this culture, they're going to assume he's just like they are, a drinker. There he is. He's a Christian. There he is with his bottle of wine. That person that says, well, I drink a little wine for health purposes. And again, I'm not condemning that, but that person had better not keep that bottle of wine where others, especially children, will see it and perhaps be harmfully influenced. For the same reason, he had better make sure he takes his little measure of wine in complete privacy, and he better take it at a time where he won't be interacting with others with the smell of wine on his breath. And finally, he had better make sure that his little regular measure of wine for health purposes doesn't get to be a little larger and a little larger, little by little. So that's a side issue. It's out of the way. We go on. This morning, we considered this very important issue in the context of the Old Testament and the Old Testament church. Now we move on to the New Testament and the New Testament church. I'm not going to try to establish. I'll tell you this ahead of time. I'm not going to try to establish what I can't establish. That is, I'm not going to insist there is in the New Testament an outright prohibition on the drinking of any alcoholic beverage for any reason. But I will tell you that the New Testament, I believe, gives us plenty of reasons to abstain, completely abstain from the drinking of intoxicating beverages. I say for pleasure drinking, as they are now doing this. We ought to just, I say, abstain from it. Abstain from drinking intoxicating beverages. I would also suggest that there is no novelty in pointing out, as we move from the Old Testament church to the New Testament church, that we are speaking of, in the first place, a church state, if you will, circumscribed by race and geographic boundaries. In the second case, we are speaking of the gospel age and a church of both Jews and Gentiles from every nation, which knows no geographic boundaries, a church blessed with far more light, glory, and power, blessings of every sort, and far more of the Spirit than the Old Testament church. So when it comes to drinking intoxicants, should there not be a higher standard than, well, the Bible doesn't say I can't so long as I don't get intoxicated, whatever that ends up meaning, I say intoxication. 1 Peter 2, the verses 11 and 12. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. Honest conversation. And this text means behavior which is good and virtuous, even beautiful, as you look back into the Greek. The drinkers can mock if they like, but somehow a Christian with a bottle of beer in his hand or a glass of some other intoxicating beverage doesn't seem to me to exude the impression of honest conversation. It doesn't seem to me to speak to unbelievers of good and virtuous behavior. When does drinking intoxicants for pleasure, just because one wants to, when doing so is such a bad example in this drinking culture, when does such pleasure drinking become indulging in a fleshly lust? Certainly not a spiritual exercise. It's just something that people want to do because it tastes good. Certainly then can become nothing but a fleshly lust. And when alcoholic drinks, which are worthless for anything but so-called pleasure, are so intimately associated with sensuality, immorality, lawlessness, drunkenness, how can a Christian elect to drink intoxicants for his own enjoyment and yet feel that he is in conformity to this? 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 22, abstain from all appearances of evil. And this, Philippians 2, verse 15, that ye may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke, in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom ye shine as lights in the world. So here we are, the Lord's own chosen people, living in the world, but not of the world, called to be the light of the world, the spiritual city set on a hill. Here we are, all around the world, living in heathen cultures where drunkenness is a consistent, constant evil. And here we are with brethren in our midst who once were enslaved to the demon of alcohol. Such were some of you. 1 Corinthians 6, 9 through 11 speaks of drunkards, idolaters, and others, and such were some of you, but ye are washed, but ye are sanctified, but ye are justified in the name of the Lord Jesus and by the Spirit of our God. So here we are, the New Testament church, Ought we to be drinking intoxicants because, well, we feel we have a liberty and we enjoy them? In the New Testament, intoxicants, which are mentioned, are strong drink and wine. Strong drink, as it's translated from the Greek, appears to cover pretty much all fermented drink, all intoxicating drinks. But it's only mentioned once. I quoted it this morning. It's in the Gospel of Luke. It has to do with John the Baptist and him being a Nazarite. For all practical purposes, only wine is mentioned in the New Testament, a number of passages. And unlike in the Old Testament, the word in the original language from which wine is translated in the New Testament always means fermented. We have to be honest. It's always fermented wine. Now, Jesus used the examples of wine and wineskins in a parable he taught. I wouldn't want to draw any conclusions from a parable with regard to should we drink wine, shouldn't we necessarily. Wine is mentioned two times prior to Christ's death and resurrection as being used in a medicinal sense. Of course, when he was on the cross, they offered our Lord wine mingled with myrrh. And then also the parable of the Good Samaritan. You remember that he went to him, the man that was wounded and lying there. The Good Samaritan went to him, it says, and bound up his wounds, pouring in oil and wine, and set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. Then there's also the wedding feast, recorded in John chapter 2, where Jesus turned water into wine. This, even from the context, appears to have been fermented wine. The Greek would tell us it was fermented wine, and it was no doubt something they were using by way of celebration. There is no doubt that the Old Testament Jews at that time still drank a certain amount of wine, fermented wine, for various reasons. Of course, you have the accounts of the Last Supper, but wine isn't mentioned there, only the cup and the fruit of the vine. The Greek in each case doesn't specifically mean fermented wine, but I certainly wouldn't try to prove it wasn't. Now, that's about it for the mention of wine or strong drink prior to Christ's death, resurrection, and the bringing in of the new covenant, the outpouring of the Holy Spirit, and the birth of the New Testament church. Every mention of wine in the book of Acts, after that point then, and then with one exception in the epistles, is in a very negative sense. It is never positive. Wine is used in the book of Revelation in only a figurative sense. Now, the one positive mention of wine in the epistles has to do with this advice from Paul to Timothy. 1 Timothy 5, verse 23. Drink no longer water, but use a little wine for thy stomach's sake and thine often infirmities. I want to be very cautious about reading too much into that verse, but it does seem to strongly imply that the pious Timothy, a minister, did not drink wine at all. It would seem that he didn't drink wine at all since he had to be urged on by Paul to do so for medicinal purposes. It's as if he's telling him, it's all right, Timothy, to use some wine for your stomach. Now, we certainly cannot draw a hard and fast conclusion from that one verse, but we can at least consider the godly example given by Timothy. Now, all of the other mentions of wine in the epistles are warnings against drunkenness. These do not outright forbid the drinking of intoxicants so long as one does not get drunk, but they certainly do again point out the great danger inherent in doing so. Yes, I know someone is going to hear this message somewhere by some other means on the internet. They're going to say, ha ha, but what about those phrases with regard to one case speaks of women, another case it speaks of elders, and the phrase is used that they're not to be given to much wine or excess of wine. The pleasure drinkers can seize on that and say, see, we have a right to drink intoxicants. It's just fine. As long as we don't drink too much or in excess. But those are warnings against drunkenness. And if we're going to see them as a blanket license, perhaps even an encouragement for pleasure drinking, then it could also be said that this, in Paul's first letter to Timothy, is a blanket prohibition on all pleasure drinking. Concerning elders, he writes that they must not be, this is 1 Timothy 3 in the verses 3, given to wine. And there the Greek is literally, they're not to get or at least stay near wine. They're supposed to be careful being around wine, so to speak. But I mean, I don't want to make my case against pleasure drinking of intoxicants with a verse like that, even if the drinkers want to base theirs on those other verses I mentioned, those other phrases really in other verses. And thinking back to the things I shared on this issue from the Old Testament, the phrase new wine is used once in the New Testament. And unlike the common use of that phrase in the Old Testament, here new wine is fermented wine. I want to make sure I cover all these bases, or someone's going to bring up these things to try to discredit the larger conclusion that I have here. At Pentecost, do you remember? The apostles were preaching in different tongues, and it says others mocking said these men are full of new wine. Well, in the Old Testament, new wine is generally non-fermented juice. Here it's obviously fermented. Acts 2:15, Peter says, for these are not drunken as ye suppose, seeing it is but the third hour of the day. So in this case, I think that new wine was fermented wine, no doubt. Obviously, this is not an endorsement for drinking wine, though, either. Now, when it comes to common fermented wine, it's clear that the Jewish people in the Old Testament and in the days of Jesus drank a certain amount of it. We know they drank it with meals. Not necessarily every meal, but they drank it generally with meals. We know that they drank a certain amount of wine at special occasions, as the wedding in Cana. The mentions of wine in the New Testament are far more, though, by way of warning against drunkenness than anything else. And then after the birth of the New Testament church, there are not any what we could call positive comments concerning wine, except in one case for medicinal purposes. The issue before us is the drinking of these intoxicating beverages by Christians who do so for enjoyment's sake. We don't see in the New Testament people drinking beer for enjoyment and this for enjoyment and sitting around with glasses of wine in their hand. We see them at meals. We see them at special occasions, no doubt. We see them prior to the New Testament being brought in, drinking in those contexts. We're talking about pleasure drinking by Christians. It's a choice. They say it's their right. They're quick to say, well, I've done no sin here, so long as I don't get drunk. And so we do have the liberty then, they say, to enjoy our alcohol. But those who defend their right to drink intoxicants for personal pleasure might want to consider the issue rather than just from the standpoint of bare permission. They might want to consider the issue from the standpoint of Christian charity, among other distinctives of Christian charity, as listed in 1 Corinthians 13, we have that charity is kind. I personally don't see any kindness toward the young, the vulnerable, the weak, the false convert, the unsaved worldling. I don't see any kindness toward such people by Christians drinking intoxicants and setting such an example. Charity, we're told, vaunteth not itself. The sense is to lift oneself up, to put oneself first. Those who insist on their liberty to drink dangerous, seductive, intoxicating beverages say, I have a right, I have a right, I have liberty. Well, they might want to consider whether charity in this matter would call them to put others before their own pleasure and enjoyment. Charity, we're told, doth not behave itself unseemly. The drinkers will disagree, of course, but I can see nothing seemly about a Christian with a bottle of beer in his hand or a glass of some other intoxicant in his hand. Charity seeketh not her own. Seeketh not her own. I have a right. I have a liberty. I enjoy it. Yeah, you're seeking your own. You're putting yourself first. Here we are in this nation at this time when drinking and drunkenness is such an epidemic and such a part of the culture. And in such a time, in such a place especially, those Christian pleasure drinkers might want to consider whether or not Christian charity would be calling them to abstain from their cherished right, their elective consumption of intoxicants for pleasure. Amid all the rhetoric concerning the Christian liberty to drink alcoholic beverages for pleasure, it needs to be remembered that such drinking is not essential. It's not helpful. It's not beneficial in any way. And intoxicants are not even just benign, neutral substances. I say it's not helpful, it's not beneficial, but it's not that they're just drinking something that is neutral or benign. As I mentioned this morning, such beverages are personified in Proverbs 20, the verse 1. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise. Now, it's all well and good to state, well, the obvious that this verse speaks of wine or strong drink indulged in past a safe point, which is different for everyone. But the reality is, this is the nature of all intoxicants and the ever-present potential inherent in them. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging. Alcoholic beverages are seductive. They are very potent, mood-changing, mind-altering, inhibition-removing, judgment-impairing substances. They can also be very addictive. And oh yes, I can hear it now from someone. Coffee can be somewhat addictive and mood-altering, can it? Well, I've never known coffee to be a factor in suicide, murder, rape, or assault. I've never heard of a woman becoming so stupefied by coffee that she would act in a way which would cause her to blush when sober and even perhaps allow an evil man to have his way with her. I've never known coffee to impair driving. I've never known coffee to embolden a man, after a couple of cups, for instance, maybe, to pick a fight with another man, even one whom he has no chance of beating. I've never heard of a man or a woman attacking a police officer, and then we hear he was under the influence of coffee. I've never known a marriage which was broken up, or a job lost, or a mind or body destroyed by coffee. I've never heard of a father or mother beating up their own children or worse because they drank too much coffee, they, the parents. I mean, demeaning sarcasm and scornful humor may be an effective rhetorical tool to deceive the minds of the simple, and it's generally hoped to intimidate the opposition. It's used in the world all the time, but such tactics are the way of the immature bully, who cannot defend his position any other way. So I would ask those Christians who stand upon their right to drink intoxicating beverages for pleasure if they believe such is the way of true Christian charity. Is it? Is it the way of selfless, benevolent love for the weak and the young among the Lord's people? Is it the way of love for our neighbors who are without the church? Is it the way of those who have a deep desire for the Church of Jesus Christ to be truly a city set on a hill, the light of the world and the salt of the earth? Is it? These are questions that need answering. Again, those Christians who defend their pleasure drinking of intoxicants ought to ask themselves, how many times did Lot get drunk? As far as we know, the just man got drunk twice, two nights in a row. And never again, never before and never again. The time was right, though, for the devil to strike. Lot had just come through a very traumatic time, including losing his home and his wife. I'm not saying that excuses him. But the fact is he was weak in every way, and the devil moved in to tempt him to drink too much wine. And then Lot went too far. He drank too much wine, and you know what followed. Considering the physical and mental condition he was no doubt in, perhaps Lot, though he even drank the same amount of wine he normally would, it affected him quicker, and then he went further. And with each drink, his inhibitions were lowered more and more. In fact, they were lowered so far that when he was dead drunk, he did the unspeakable. Committed the horrific sin of incest. Those who indulge in the drinking of intoxicants for pleasure are playing with fire. And even if they never get burned themselves, they're putting many others at risk of falling into the sin of drunkenness and then the things that go with that sin. Oh, it's all well and good to make jokes about the drunk, but it's a horrible thing, drunkenness. Terrible things happen. It's not just the falling down. I guess people think it's comical. Terrible things happen with drunkenness. The issue of drinking intoxicants for pleasure is not, I repeat, not all capitals, not an issue of Christian liberty. Now, the drinker will screech, it is too. I have liberty. Yes, you do. You have liberty, you say. I can drink a glass of wine or I can drink an intoxicant as long as I don't get drunk. You have liberty. But it is not Christian liberty. Do you not know what Christian liberty is? Those who frame it as such as Christian liberty mock Christian liberty. The issue of pleasure drinking is an issue of personal liberty. It's a simple matter of personal preference concerning an action which may not be actually forbidden on its face, but which charity should lead us to abstain from. No, this is not about Christian liberty. It's about a personal liberty which has no real benefit and which has injured, even in some cases enslaved, even destroyed a great many men, women, and young people. I've already raised the issue of Christian charity. Charity, Christian charity, the selfless, benevolent love of Christian charity. Now, the Christian drinker can go ahead and claim his right to drink intoxicants, but what about charity? What about love? The whole moral law of God is comprehended by these two commandments, the first and the greatest being, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now, as Christians, we're no longer under the covenant of works, but we understand that the moral law is still our rule for obedience. We also know that the law is spiritual, reaching to our hearts, that is, to our understanding, our very thoughts, our affections, our intents and motives, as well as our words, works, and gestures. We know that for each sin forbidden, there is a contrary duty required. As Christians, we see the moral law as holy and just and good and immutable and unchanging. As Christians, we are enabled to love the moral law and seek out of love to obey it from the heart in love. Now, the pleasure drinking of intoxicants by Christians has no good, worthwhile purpose whatever. It seems to me, as I consider the situation, the calling of the New Testament church, and when I consider the deceptive and potent power of intoxicants, especially on the young and persons in certain circumstances, and when I consider the awful, dark, destructive, pervasive consequences of drunkenness in the unsaved around us, and our duty to be a city set on a hill, when I consider all of this in the light of Christian charity and in the light of the moral law, which to the Christian is the law of love, it seems to me the right thing for a Christian to do is abstain completely from intoxicating beverages, As Paul declared when speaking of the second table of the law, Romans 13, the verse 10, love worketh no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. Now, I want to be very clear on this and listen very well. I am not, absolutely not, making the claim that a Christian is violating the moral law of God by the act of consuming an intoxicant. If that were so, then even Jesus would have violated the moral law, since it has always been the same unchanging, immutable revelation of God's will. I am saying if Jesus did indeed drink fermented wine at any time, he would have been violating the moral law if, for us today, drinking an intoxicant violates the moral law. It cannot. But what of this? Love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfilling of the law. Is there no principle, though, to apply to pleasure drinking by Christians? We're talking about pleasure drinking by Christians, not just the ingesting of an alcoholic drink. We're just talking about a way of life. We're talking about pleasure drinking. Is there no principle there? Love worketh no ill to his neighbor. Is there no principle there to apply to pleasure drinking by Christians, at least, the very least, at this time in this day? Intoxicants are deceptive. They are powerful. They are potent, mood-changing, mind-altering, inhibition-removing, judgment-impairing, potentially deadly substances. They also have an addictive quality. Here's the world celebrating the drinking of such substances as beer and wine and whiskey, and the list goes on and on. America has a drinking culture. The further from God nations go, the more people drink beer, wine, and liquor. They drink and they get drunk. Primitive peoples, as they're called, that have been discovered in far corners of the world, had their liquor and their drinking problem, so to speak. It's always been so. Alcohol consumption, drinking, if you will, has resulted in the loss of personal purity for millions of young men and women. It's resulted in countless traffic deaths and maimings of both drinkers and their innocent victims. Drinking has been the cause of other deaths and injuries as well. Drinking has destroyed marriages, destroyed families, destroyed careers, destroyed jobs, minds, and morals. Drinking has been a major factor in much violence, including many murders and rapes and suicides. Yes, in a very limited amount, wine is said to have certain health benefits. But I'm sure they could be realized in other ways. But there is not one single good or benefit that can be named from drinking intoxicants, such as beer or what we would call hard liquor, or with the one exception, wine. And so is this the way of the Christian to insist for the sake of personal enjoyment that he has the liberty to indulge in intoxicating beverages which are destroying his neighbor, including many young? Is that the way of love? Is that the way of charity? Is that possibly working ill to our neighbor? Is this consistent with being salt and light in a dark, deceived, dying world? I want us to next consider several passages from the Scriptures which have as their context, and again, I have to be very clear, the context is the eating of meat bought in the marketplace during those early years of the New Testament dispensation. Meat which may or may not have been sacrificed to idols. It was unknown. This was not a case of someone saying, here, eat this, it was sacrificed to idols. But rather, in cities such as Corinth, there was always a possibility that meat bought in the marketplace may have been bought in the shambles. And so there were among the Christian brethren those who just couldn't bring themselves to eat such meat, just in case, so to speak. Now, they were spiritually weak. That's the reality. But Paul nevertheless warned other brethren were more strong that they should take care not to cause such a one to go against his conscience and do that which he was convinced was a sin against God. And so then he would defile his conscience, as Paul warns in 1 Corinthians 8, verse 7, And he would bring himself under condemnation even, as Paul warns again in Romans chapter 14. There was a need to patiently convince such a brother that eating meat was not a sin. But to shame or pressure him to eat against his conscience was to cause him to eat with a sinful motive. That is, to purposely do what he was convinced of in his mind was a sin against God. And there is more that could be said about the context of a couple of verses I want to mention, but I wanted to mention the context so we don't get into any kind of confusion. Now, keeping in mind the context of the several verses I want to put before us, we can nevertheless find an obvious general abiding principle in them. That's why I'm putting them in front of us, for an abiding principle that we find here, which ought to be applied to the drinking of intoxicants, much more so than as we go back in New Testament history and we see the situation with the meat. 1 Corinthians 8, the verses 9, "But take heed lest by any means this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to them that are weak." Yes, the context is that Paul was speaking about the eating of meat, the eating of a nutritious, beneficial foodstuff. And he says, take heed, given this situation, that you don't exercise your liberty in such a way this liberty becomes a stumbling block to those that are weak. But what about Christians drinking alcoholic beverages for pleasure? In contrast to meat, there's no benefit in doing so. There's no real good that comes of doing so. There's much danger inherent in doing so. Is such a so-called liberty then worth exercising when it's such a stumbling block for so many? And what about Romans 14, verse 21? "It is good neither to eat flesh nor to drink wine nor anything whereby thy brother stumbleth or is offended or is made weak." Oh, we could talk much about the context of this and make sure we don't get misunderstood, but we don't have time. We see it's said here, it's good neither to eat flesh. Well, we know the context of the eating of the flesh. But what about wine? It's good not to drink wine nor anything, it says, whereby thy brother stumbleth or is offended or is made weak, it goes on. What about wine? Both Jews and Gentiles drank wine as part of their diets. It was not considered unclean by either. But Paul writes to the Christian, whether Jew or Gentile, that it's good not to drink wine whereby thy brother stumbleth or is offended or is made weak. He does not absolutely forbid the drinking of wine, but certainly there is a principle of charity here, is there not? And a strong admonition to exercise it. What do you think? How should we apply that principle in our day, in this lawless, drunken culture, when so much worldliness has come into the church and the young are subject to so much pressure? What do you think? It's good not to do these things that cause our brother to stumble or be offended or made weak, and wine, intoxicating beverages are mentioned. What do you think? What if the young and impressionable see their minister or father or mother or any Christian man or woman they look up to drink wine or beer or some other alcoholic drink? Do you not think that could cause that young person to become ensnared by the power of alcohol? To get into that drinking culture even with everything that goes with it. Is every young person in the church of the same spiritual and mental and emotional makeup and experience? Are the pleasure drinkers willing to sacrifice the most vulnerable in order to enjoy their wine and their beer and their liquor? And what about the adult who is nevertheless a weaker brother or sister, who may start out drinking with great moderation and great care, but ends up under the power of intoxicants, perhaps only once like Noah or twice like Lot, or perhaps far more? Where is Christian conscience in this matter? Where is charity? Any Christian man or woman who drinks intoxicating beverages, who also claims that they're not putting their brethren, including youngsters, at risk of stumbling and falling into sin, are certainly deceiving themselves, and they're hoping to deceive others. 1 John 2, verse 10. He that loveth his brother abideth in the light, and there is none occasion of stumbling in him. Now, this is not in the context of meat bought in the shambles. Not at all. This is a general abiding principle, and it ought to be applied certainly to drinking intoxicants. He that loveth his brother abideth in the light, and there is none occasion of stumbling in him. It is without controversy that even good and useful things can be misused. Christians are not required to abstain from the use of such things because a Christian brother might misuse them. But we need to keep this in perspective. The issue is the drinking of intoxicating beverages for pleasure. There is no loss whatsoever incurred from abstaining from such pleasure drinking. There is a terrible amount of danger involved in such pleasure drinking. He that loveth his brother abideth in the light, and there is none occasion of stumbling in him. Can the pleasure drinkers say that they're holding true to that abiding principle enunciated in 1 John 2, verse 10? Now, someone may have the proud audacity to say, well, I derive much benefit from the fellowship I have with others during social drinking because you said there's no benefit in it, but I get pleasure from that fellowship. Well, I pity such a one who has to have fellowship involving intoxicants or he'll have no benefit from it. Says something about him. I also pity anyone who's so foolish and selfishly disingenuous as to insist their drinking of alcohol cannot cause other brethren to stumble, perhaps a great many to stumble. The drinking of intoxicants in this day and age, especially in culture, is totally inconsistent with 1 John 2, the verse 10. He that loveth his brother abideth in the light, and there is none occasion of stumbling in him. Now, the drinker who may hear this message can protest then that he finds no prohibition in the Bible against the pleasure drinking of intoxicants. I answer that such drinking violates Christian charity, that it is selfish, that it makes an occasion for others to stumble, that it gives the world a wrong image of Christianity, and that it is an arrogant playing with fire. And one last thing. I find it utterly amazing that some unsaved parents have more conscience and concern for their children in such a matter as this than do some Christian parents. There are unsaved parents who give up even occasional social drinking, such as on holidays or family gatherings, and refuse to have any alcoholic drink in their house for any reason. Why? Because they are so pious and godly? No. Because they love their children so much. Because they don't want to set a bad example for their beloved children because they know the destructive potential in intoxicating beverages, the destructive potential which is inherent with alcoholic beverages of any kind, all intoxicants. How shameful that some unsaved parents so willingly forego their liberty to drink intoxicating beverages in moderation for their own pleasure. Yet more and more Christians are so unwilling to give up that same liberty for the sake of their own children, or if they don't have children, other children. How shameful to find more love and wisdom among some unbelievers than among some Christians. And let me repeat, the issue of drinking intoxicants for pleasure is not an issue of Christian liberty. That makes a mockery of what Christian liberty is. The issue of pleasure drinking is an issue of personal liberty. It's a matter of personal preference concerning an action which may not be actually forbidden on its face, but which charity should lead us to abstain from. Oh, but in this selfish age, far be it from me to suggest Christians abstain totally from intoxicants out of love for their neighbor, both their brethren and the unsaved, including the young and vulnerable, in some cases their own children, and out of a concern for the honor and glory of Christ. Oh, this is a terrible burden to put upon the followers of Jesus, who said, if any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. Now, I would hardly classify totally abstaining from wine, beer, and booze of all kinds a cross. Yet, so many will not do it. They must have their so-called enjoyment. They must exercise their precious so-called liberty. Well, in closing, I will stress again, I have not said and will not say that Christians are straightly forbidden by the Word of God to drink any alcoholic beverage. But I believe the same Word of God does show the New Testament Christian, to quote from the Apostle, a more excellent way, the way of charity, wisdom, and safety. Amen.